From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2015 in New Jersey when a man named Michael Olanowski was pulled over. He was charged with driving while intoxicated, but he wasn't drunk. An officer trained as a drug recognition expert, or DRE, decided that Olanowski was under the influence of drugs. For years, the Olanowski case would be under legal dispute, with public defenders in New Jersey arguing that DREs do not have some special power and that their opinion should not carry the same weight as, say, a breathalyzer for alcohol or other scientific standards for measuring evidence. But law enforcement disagrees. Here's what the International Association of Chiefs of Police says, quote, "A properly trained DRE can successfully identify drug impairment and accurately determine the category of drugs causing such," end quote. Already law firms and public defenders are digging into the training and the science. Here's how one defense firm describes DREs in our area. Quote, "Drug recognition experts simply lack the scientific and medical expertise to diagnose medical symptoms. And even when they accurately determine that a driver is impaired by cocaine or fentanyl, for example, they've done no more than make a somewhat educated guess," end quote. The New Jersey case aimed to decide just how reliable DREs are, and that especially matters because more states are legalizing drugs for recreational purposes. Here in New York State, what happens if you smoke a joint and then drive? Who decides whether you're too high to drive? As law enforcement explains it, drug recognition experts are trained to determine whether drivers are impaired by drugs that can't be detected by roadside tests, blood work, or breathalyzers. And this isn't new. DREs have been doing this kind of work for decades now. But cases like the one in New Jersey indicate that the courts are trying to determine just how strong this kind of evidence should be under the law. And ultimately, the New Jersey court gave a kind of split decision. First, a win for law enforcement. The court in New Jersey decided that DRE testimony was admissible as evidence. State authorities celebrated the ruling, saying it would lead to safer roadways. But there were caveats. First, the majority of New Jersey justices decided that DREs will not be able to say a driver was impaired because they took a given drug, only that their impairment is consistent with the effects of certain drugs. And this was a win for public defenders who have long said that DREs are given too much latitude to specifically declare what drug a person had definitively taken. Second, the court's majority said that the issue needed further study and could be revisited in the future. And in the dissenting opinion, two New Jersey justices wrote that the court had, quote, "approved the admissibility of drug recognition expert testimony despite admitting that they could not determine its reliability," end quote. Those justices wrote further, quote, "the majority opinion discounts legitimate concerns about the reliability and the accuracy of the DRE protocol and upholds the admission of DRE evidence despite acknowledging that the factors of testability and false positive error rate are largely inconclusive and that DRE testimony does not, in and of itself, establish impairment," end quote. So what about in New York State? How does the legalization of marijuana affect the work of DREs, if at all? What should we all know about driving while impaired, for example? And how are DREs trained? There's a lot of work that goes into this. And again, as I said, they've been doing it for decades. Our guests this hour include Sergeant David Olney, who is a station commander for Troop D, a DRE himself, a drug recognition expert and instructor, and a UAS pilot and troop coordinator for the New York State Police. Sergeant Olney, thank you for being on the program today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Delton Carraway is with us. Del is an Ontario County Assistant Public Defender. Del, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let me start with Sergeant Olney. You know, for people who aren't familiar with your work, do you want to describe a little bit about what it means to be a DRE?
Well, a DRE goes through some pretty extensive training. First, to even be a candidate to become a drug recognition expert, you have to have successfully completed standardized field sobriety testing training and ARIDE, it's Advanced Roadside Impaired Driving Enforcement Training. You successfully complete those, and then you have to sit through an interview panel process to be selected to attend the DRE school. The interview panel process, you know, you come in and you sit in front of the state coordinator and, you know, four or five DREs. Instructors, and we ask questions, and based on how well the candidate does, then they're selected to attend the school. The school is quite lengthy. It's 2 weeks in a classroom. There's the preschool and the 7-day school. It deals with alcohol right up into drugs and combination of drugs and physiology. There's a whole gamut of things it deals with. It's very, very intensive training, very in-depth training. And one of the things we tell our DREs is that is not the end of your training. That's just the beginning of your training. Once that classroom training is done, then we do our field certifications where the DRE is required to do a certain amount of evaluations under the supervision of an instructor or instructors before they're finally certified. Once they're certified, then they go through a probationary period, which could be up to a year, where anytime they do an evaluation, that evaluation is then looked at by instructor or coordinator to make sure we're on the correct path. So it's a pretty extensive training. It's something we definitely don't take lightly across the state. It's a National Highway Traffic Safety Administration program that is overseen by each state.
Okay, and the numbers I've read indicate that New York now has more than 500 total DREs in the state. Does that sound correct?
As of this morning, it's around 433, okay. Something like that.
Okay, so about 430. And how long have you been a DRE?
1997.
So how many DREs were there back in when you were starting out?
Not a lot. In fact, we've hovered between 100 and 200 for a long, long time. And then in the last few years, we've increased our training statewide to hold more classes throughout the year so we could get more drug recognition experts. Some of the big challenges with the classes is they're very labor intensive for manpower, and for an agency to give up an instructor for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks at a time, it's very difficult. That's why it was hard to hold classes. And then typically we get very motivated police officers that are very interested in becoming drug recognition experts. And shortly after they become drug recognition experts, they end up getting themselves promoted because they're, you know, very active, very good police officers that they naturally advance through their career, and then we lose them as DREs and we got to start all over again. So we're pretty stagnant under 200 for a long time. And now, you know, to double that has been quite an effort statewide for all the instructors and agencies and Governor's Traffic Safety Committee to manage this.
Does the legalization of recreational marijuana change the urgency to add DREs?
It does in that there are a lot of people out there, you know, that they look at the legalization of marijuana. If it's legal, then it's okay to drive when I'm using it. It's just like alcohol, or back in the 90s and early 2000s, or mid, you know, 2009, 2010, when bath salts and things like that, mm-hmm. synthetic cannabis were out there, and people, you know, didn't think that they could be arrested for driving under the influence of those things. When just like alcohol, you can drink all the alcohol you want to, but you can't get behind the wheel after a certain level. And that's an obvious, at least obvious to us, an obvious jump where people, you know, okay, it's legal now, it's not that bad. So we anticipated an increase in people driving under the influence of drugs.
We're talking to Sergeant David Olney, a station commander for Troop D, a DRE himself, a drug recognition expert, and an instructor. So listeners, when you hear DRE this hour, again, that's drug recognition expert. It is a category of police officer that has received special training on recognizing drugs, especially in the field, to help determine if someone is impaired. And before I turn to our guest in studio, I just wanted to ask our guest on the line one more question about how this works. And I'm reading what the International Association of Chiefs of Police says one more time here. I'm going to quote them one more time. A properly trained DRE can successfully identify drug impairment and accurately determine the category of drugs causing such, end quote. Can you explain more of what that means and how you do it?
Yeah, I can try. So we, and when I say we, I'm talking about the program,
yep.
And that's
yep.
internationally. So we've grouped, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, and I'm sure the other people on this discussion will agree that there are thousands and thousands of drugs out there. And sometimes things don't fit perfectly in one single category, but they've grouped the drugs out there that can impair a person's ability to operate a vehicle safely into one of seven categories. And those categories are divided up by how they manifest in a person, what a person looks like when they're using the drugs, the things that we're looking for, like what their eyes do, their pulse, their blood pressure, their body temperature, their muscle tone, general indicators, things like that.
And Sergeant, just let me interrupt for 1 second. All of a sudden you got a little muffled, so I just want to make sure we can hear you clearly. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Is that better?
Much better. Yep. Go ahead.
I apologize. So they've taken the drugs that can impair a person's ability to operate a vehicle safely and grouped them into one of seven drug categories. And when someone's using just that category and not a combination of categories, there are obvious things that are different between a healthy, non-impaired person and somebody who is under the influence of a drug. And those differences can be seen generally in either the eyes or the physiology of that person, like pulse, blood pressure, body temperature, muscle rigidity, and then general indicators. And they've taken those indicators and those things we're looking for, and each one of those seven drug categories appears different when you're looking at that person. So to oversimplify it, you basically look at things like the eyes, and there's a bunch of different things we look for in the eyes, and then pulse, blood pressure, body temperature, things like that. And you look and see what your result is. Is it above normal, normal range, below normal range? And basically plug it into what's called the matrix. At the end of an evaluation, you make a determination on based on your opinion. It's more likely than not that this drug category is what may be causing the impairment. And in the introduction to your section here, you mentioned the word that we make a diagnosis. DREs don't diagnose
okay,
anything.
Yep, fair enough.
It's an opinion based on the things that we are seeing, the indicators that we're seeing this person during our evaluation, which evaluation takes 45 minutes to an hour. It's a 12-step evaluation that we go methodically right down through the steps and look at this person and see what they are showing us, whether it's, whether it's an indicator or a thing we're looking at, like, pulse, blood pressure, body temperature. There's what's a normal range for a healthy, non-impaired person versus what we considered high, what would be considered low. And at the end of the evaluation, we take our observations, basically plug them into the matrix and see where this person stands. The one thing, really important thing to remember is if someone passes field sobriety tests, it doesn't matter if they're impaired by alcohol or a drug or whatever. If they pass their field sobriety tests, they're not impaired. It's just like you can drink a drink or two and not be impaired by alcohol. You shouldn't get arrested for DWI. If you're a very low BAC and you're not impaired, that police officer is going to be able to recognize that. Or at somebody who's not even trained generally could recognize if somebody's impaired or not from a distance if they're heavily impaired by alcohol or not impaired at all by alcohol. And that pretty much stays that way with drug impairment. I mean, we're basically looking at, is this person impaired? And if they're impaired, what could be causing that impairment?
Okay, talking to Del Caraway in studio now, who's an assistant, Ontario County Assistant Public Defender. Can you describe, Del, how often these kind of cases come up and if you've seen change over the years?
Sure. So I just a little bit of background is I moved here from Broome County in 2013. I was a prosecutor down there. And when I came up here and I started working for the Public Defender's Office, I came kind of enamored by these officers, DRE expert or, witnesses, because, frankly, there weren't a lot of them in generally all mostly around the state. There weren't a whole lot of them, especially not down in the southern tier. Very few cases actually had a DRE in them. When I moved up here, I noticed that, almost every case that I dealt with an impaired driving allegation had a DRE attached, which was unique. And so I came to be kind of interested in trying to look at, you know, what has, what this, process entailed, things like that. And, I've kind of, gone to study on them for ever since. I think what's changed a lot is obviously the big one is obviously the number of DREs that are in the area. Like you said, it's gone from 100 one to 200
between
to almost,
400 and 500. About 430, I think.
Right. And
was what
so,
we were told, yeah.
Right. And I think that's one of the biggest changes is that, we see them more. Because before these cases weren't really going to trial that much. I mean, you hear the word drug recognition expert, that's intimidating. And, frankly, I think that might be intentionally so, but, I think that when you hear that word, it imbues a kind of infallibility. And so these cases weren't being contested or tried. Now they are. I think we're starting to understand the science behind them a little bit. They're back in when the DRE program started, there were only a couple validation studies. Now there are a lot, and I think the one of the biggest pushes, and I agree with Sergeant Olney, where the legalization of marijuana has really upped the game here. It's actually right built into the MRTA, the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act, that there's funding added to the state for advanced training of DREs and things like that, which is great. I mean, I don't want to discount. I think that no one should be driving while impaired. That's certainly not what I'd be advocating.
And do you think it's valid for police to train DREs?
Oh, I think it's definitely valid for police to train officers in recognizing when someone might be impaired by a drug. I think where the disconnect for me is the fact that the DRE program in and of itself it bases itself on some assumptions that aren't entirely accurate. It also kind of sees itself as in like I said, an infallible system. I think where I was noticing it is a couple years ago there was a couple news reports out in Arizona and in Georgia where people were being arrested for and accused of impaired driving, and there was nothing in their system, and the DRE's response to that was often, just because there was nothing in their system doesn't mean that my analysis was wrong, that my call was wrong. So, even when, someone has shown that they don't have any, drugs in their system, that DRE can still, make a call. And I think that my biggest concern with that is, and I'm going to butcher the quote, but there's a quote by Karl Popper. Basically, he says that which is not, and I'm sorry, I'm going to butcher it again, but he says that which is not falsifiable is not scientific, meaning that if it can't be proven wrong, then it's not a scientific method.
So what kind of weight should a DRE's testimony have then in your mind?
I think that I think that Olenowski in and of itself, I mean,
this is the New Jersey. If for listeners just joining us, this is the New Jersey case that became a big focus of New Jersey's decision and their high court's decision on whether DRE testimony should be allowable. Go ahead.
I think that Olenowski, I disagree with a lot of the premises, but I think they got a lot right when they said that a DRE can testify that this is consistent with impairment by a certain category, but. That it shouldn't be a, this is my opinion that this person is impaired by this category of drug.
Let me try to put this in more layman's terms. I think what the New Jersey High Court said is, if you're a DRE, you can testify that a person's actions were consistent with being, for example, high on marijuana, impaired by marijuana, but you cannot say they definitively were impaired by marijuana. Is that correct? Is that the right way of describing it?
Or
pick another drug.
I mean,
their actions are consistent with showing impairment by that drug, but that DRE can't say that person was impaired by that drug.
Right.
On their own.
And I think that's kind of, again, where I have the issue with, when you put an officer who clearly knows what they're talking about, but you put them on the stand and you call them an expert before anyone has even, validated their expertise and, the basis behind it. you know, there's been a big push I've seen to call them, you know, drug recognition evaluators or something like that. And I think that the word expert kind of imbues a little bit more. You know, I really am just kind of, you know, I was struck, you know, when Sergeant Olney was talking, he said, you know, if someone fails a field sobriety test, then they're not impaired. What's
No. He said if they don't fail, just because, yeah, if they don't fail
right.
a field sobriety test,
sorry
then they're
about
not
that.
Impaired. Yeah, go ahead.
But, you know, the thing about the standardized field sobriety tests is, you know, the standardized field sobriety tests were created and only validated for alcohol. They weren't ever validated for, you know, drug impairments. So and they look a lot different. As I you know, old, you know, Sergeant Olney, you know, specifically, I would agree with. It does look a lot different than someone impaired with alcohol. But we're using the same tests, and I think that's kind of, you know, something that we need to work on. I know that NHTSA, the agency that actually National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that actually trains the DREs, they came out with a report in 2017 to Congress. It was a national report, and it you know, said very specifically the psychomotor tests that a DRE relies on, you know, are not great at determining, you know, specifically cannabis impairment. So I think we need better testing. I don't think that we need to scrap the program. I just think we need to get better.
Okay. Let me ask Sergeant David Olney a question, who's a DRE, a drug recognition expert, and an instructor in this. Do you, if you were to, in the next week, let's just say, or the next month, however long it would take, your next 100 field stops where you're doing this, how many times do you think you would get it wrong, Sergeant?
I would, so the program nationally has about a 92.5, this is the last study I saw, about a 92.5 success rate of calling impairment and having the toxicological examination corroborate what the DRE's opinion was.
Okay, and that sounds about fair. That's probably a good guess for what you think you would do in the field, about 92-93% maybe?
I've consistently ran around there. And there are a lot of outliers. I mean, there's, you never say never, you never say always. There are a lot of things that look different. I will say that, just to go back one second,
mm-hmm.
to
yeah, sure.
what Mr. Carraway said, I agree with a lot of things he's saying. But impairment is impairment. If somebody's impaired, and there's not a lot of different ways from what I've seen that impairment will manifest itself. I mean, you think about somebody walking in line, you think about somebody touching your nose, you think about somebody standing on one leg. If somebody's impaired, regardless of what's causing that impairment, they're going to show impairment. I mean, it kind of sounds silly using using that impairment so many times in the same sentence, but impairment is impairment. We don't have other validated studies or field sobriety tests to perform on the side of the road. There are no other, there's not a breath test for cannabis or PCP or heroin. Like there is a portable breath test to use on the side of the road for alcohol. So I mean, we are kind of limited to the tools that are in our toolbox right now. And I'm sure you'll both agree that impaired driving is very serious and very dangerous. Police officers are out there doing their level best with the tools they have to determine, you know, what's going on or why somebody's impaired. And sometimes when people get interviewed on the side of the road, it's not impairment, it's something else going on. And that's one of the things we really stress heavily is what are other things that could be making somebody look like they're impaired. We really, really stress the integrity of the program. And I certainly understand some of the things that Mr. Carraway was saying about, you know, somebody being arrested and the tox coming back without the substance being in the person's system. And there's really a lot of reasons why that could happen. Some support the program, some don't.
I was just going to say, if I could just, you know, I mean, you know, add to that a little bit. And I certainly agree with you, Sergeant, that, you know, keeping, you know, impaired drivers off the road is incredibly important. And I you know, I appreciate the work you guys do. I think there, my concern is mostly on the other side of it. You know, for, like you said, there are a lot of things that can look like impairment that aren't. You know, I'll use myself as an example. I have ADHD, and, I have trouble, organizing, you know, with executive functioning and dividing attention, the things that you would be expected to do to drive a vehicle. And I take a medication that, you know, frankly assists me in doing those things that would look like, without my medication, would look like, specifically cannabis impairment. My problem isn't so much that, you know, that you're, you know, not, you know, no, I mean, that you're, you know, doing anything wrong. I think that the DRE program, you know, has a noble purpose, and I think that we need to, you know, get better at it. But I also think that my concern there is, I would point, especially when you're talking about these 92%, you know, statistics, that those tests were done, you know, back in the early 90s. And there have been later ones later that show a much less success rate. And there was also a, specifically, there was a recent test this year, or a recent study this year, but I think by Marilyn Hustis, the same person who does a lot of the, DRE validations, is that specifically with cannabis, when they were trying to find, tests that would work for cannabis impairment, what they found was a lot of the people on that test that were not impaired were actually failing standardized field sobriety tests, even though there was nothing in their system. So I understand that the field sobriety testing is an important way for officers to determine whether or not someone might be impaired, especially roadside. But on the same token, there's a lot more that, going on that, that sometimes is not considered. I think that, like anybody, officers can sometimes be subject to confirmation bias.
State Police Sergeant Olney, you want to respond to that?
There's a lot there. Like I said, I don't disagree with some of those things, and those are things that we go out of our way to be careful about. And is there confirmation bias? In any line of work, people instinctively want to be right, and we try to caution about that. We try to look at things objectively. Your medication you take for ADHD. You take it so you can be in that, and I'm making the finger quote here, in that normal functioning range. So you're able to focus and you're able to function normally. If you took too much of that medication, arguably you could be or would be impaired if you took too much of it.
Absolutely.
Now you're saying if you didn't take it, would you look impaired? And it's the totality of things. I do a lot of demonstrations for courts and juries, or used to anyways, and you always get, when you go to the question answer, and you always say, well, who's got questions? And then somebody raise their hand and say, I couldn't do that test sober. You know, you hear that a lot. And you stand them up and you run through a couple of tests, and do they score a couple of clues somewhere along during the test? Everybody has the potential to do that. But you're looking at the totality. And if you score, two clues on the walk and turn test, or three clues on the walk and turn test, and you do great on everything else, we're going to try to be objective and look at the totality there. And, again, we're not trying to put something in a box that isn't there. We're trying to make sense of what we're seeing in front of us.
Sergeant, a quick question from David before we take our only break, and then we're going to take more. We're going to get some phone calls and get more feedback on the other side of our only break here. David just wants to know, why don't police take a blood sample at the scene and simply determine whether the person under arrest is under the influence of drugs or not? Sergeant?
That's a great question. So at the scene, who's going to take the blood sample? You got to have a trained phlebotomist. Just like at the scene of a traffic stop, we don't take an evidentiary breast sample. We take a pre-arrest breath screening test, the handheld, or they call it the ELCA sensor, and that's not admissible in court. So at the scene, we're basically in an investigatory stage where we're trying to determine, is there impairment? and should this person be arrested at that time? And then we go back, and if we determine that there's impairment and the person should be arrested, then we're going to give the breath test. And if possible, if necessary, we're going to give a blood test afterward. So it's very difficult to do it at the scene. We wouldn't even do an evidentiary breath test at the scene. That's all done later on back at the station once we've determined that an arrest should be made.
Dell, anything you want to add briefly before we get our only break in?
Yeah,
here?
Sorry, I'll try and be as brief as I can, but I totally agree. I don't believe it would be completely feasible to take blood at the scene. But on the same token, the thing with the blood test that makes it even more complicated is that, drugs and alcohol don't really work the same way. You know, blood, alcohol content, in alcohol, we've studied it very well. It's very linear. The more you drink, the drunker you get, the higher your blood alcohol content goes. Cannabis and other drugs don't work that way. In fact, all the studies have said, the blood level in some, the amount of blood, THC in someone's blood doesn't correlate well with how impaired they are. So, it's very hard just to look at a blood test and say, that person might be impaired. So that's why we do need other ways.
That's actually a great point. And I like to take everything back to alcohol because everybody's seen somebody who's drank a lot or drank a little bit. And a lay person with little or no training can see somebody across the other side of the room and say that person's drunk just by things they're exhibiting. And you have people that are very, very experienced drinkers that can handle a certain amount of alcohol and not give off a lot of indicators. And you have people that aren't experienced drinkers that can't handle just a little bit amount of alcohol, and they give off indicators appearing they're very intoxicated. And with drugs, again, it isn't a linear thing, and there isn't a magic number where we all know that the legal limit for DWI in New York State is 0.08 and DWI is lower than that. There is no number in nanograms in cannabis that you can have in your system, and it does affect people differently.
So after we take this only break, we'll continue with some feedback. And if you're just joining us, this is a conversation about an issue that is not necessarily new, but it's one that's getting fresher emphasis because of the legalization of recreational marijuana in New York State. For police officers, you heard Sergeant David Olney from the New York State Police explain they don't have trained phlebotomists on scene. They're not taking your blood every time you get pulled over to evaluate whether you have drugs in your system. And so police officers, roughly 430, he says, in this state, have been trained as DREs, drug recognition experts. They go through special training. They are trained, as the police will tell you, to recognize if you are impaired, not necessarily by alcohol, but by drugs, and even what class of drug, what kind of drug. And that testimony can be very powerful in court settings. Public defenders have said, okay, that's understandable the police would want to train with that, but that should not be the be-all, end-all of evidence, and that is not the same as something much more scientific, and so we should be very careful about presenting them as experts to juries who might decide anything they say is the gold standard. So it is a sort of an evolving field, especially with more legalization happening, and that's why there are more DREs on the road now. About 100, maybe 200 a generation ago, and now well over double that, on our way to 500 in this state. Let's take our only break. We'll come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, data shows that the rates of pediatric and young adult cancers are on the rise. Why is that happening? And when that does happen, the survivors often have more significant mental health challenges than their peers who have not had cancer. We're going to talk to professionals in the community, and we'll talk to family members about what kids and young adults need. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This conversation has aroused the interest of a number of people. I've read a few emails already. I'll get back to your emails at connections@wxxi.org. If you want to call the program, we'll take as many calls as we can get at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And one of those callers on the line with us now is James, Dr. James O'Donnell, who's a pharmacologist who is on the line with us. Dr. O'Donnell, welcome.
Good,
how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
You're a pharmacologist who has testified in DRE cases, is that correct?
I am, yes, that is correct.
Okay, and you're someone who is, your services, you get hired to go to cases and present your own testimony about just how valid or not DRE's testimony should be. Is that also fair, Dr. O'Donnell?
Well, it's twofold. Is the evidence presented and the conclusions made by the DRE officer scientifically and clinically valid? And then secondly, my opinions as to the validity of the DRE itself compared to mainline pharmacological and medical sciences.
Okay, and how many times have you testified in cases like this?
I have 10 to 20 cases I've given testimony and I've reviewed another 10 or 20 others that were on the way to court and resolved after my report was received and considered by the prosecutor. And I also want to say for balance that I testify and consult to prosecutors as well as public defenders and private defense attorneys in criminal matters. But overwhelmingly, my work is in civil drug injury cases. I look at a drug and what it does and what the evidence, how the evidence supports whether or not it the outcome or injury or impairment is supported by the evidence found both clinically and toxicologically by a drug test.
Okay, and so Dr. O'Donnell, you've got Sergeant Olney and frankly many police officers, and I've been reading comments leading up to this conversation today, and a lot of police officers saying, look, we have more drugs, you know, we're seeing more legalization, particularly of marijuana. We're seeing different laws in different states, and we don't have phlebotomists who are out at every scene. We have to do our very, very best to be trained to recognize what is going on here. And, you know, a breathalyzer is one thing for alcohol. We don't have a perfect test for many different categories of drugs, but we need police who are able to pretty consistently recognize when someone is impaired, which means they may be endangering others or themselves. And so what is your, I guess, professional opinion on how police officers are doing with this and basically the idea that they need to be doing this work because they're trying to keep the road safer for all of us?
Well, I recognize that, and I know that that's a responsibility and it is a public safety issue. But the problem is the DRE, and we agree with Mr. Carraway, they're not experts. Sergeant described extensive training. It's 2 weeks of training. For instance, I have 7 years of training and 50 years experience. The sergeant described considering the physiology. They're expert police officers. They're not expert drug recognition evaluators. They're not experts, and I agree they shouldn't be introduced as experts. The physiology and the consideration of the history that is described by the DRE program would challenge a clinician, a clinical pharmacist, a clinical pharmacologist, or a physicians, and the conclusions that are drawn and the attribution of to a particular effect of a drug by many of the matrix indicators are faulty. They're scientifically faulty. Historically, having read the history of the DRE, this was introduced when people were in the 70s when they're doing heroin, PCP, and LSD. Now people are being prosecuted for using drugs like Prozac, blood pressure medication, anti-anxiety medications, and so forth. So I think the greatest danger, the greatest societal danger of the DRE, because
are you asserting that some of those drugs aren't going to impair a person?
Well, if the people are. Well, you're suggesting that they can, and clearly they are. But those are drugs that I've isolated now, the prescription medications that are prescribed by a physician or provider, and the patients go back and see that provider or physician. And if they are having impairments, they are detected clinically. They ask the patient, how you doing? Call me if you have any complaints. And I've seen DREs where people have been taking these medications for 5-10 years, and a DRE has found that because they admit to using a certain medication, they find some indicators that are not valid and are not caused by a particular prescription medication. The DRE draws a conclusion that they are impaired based on their compliance with the matrix. And indeed, if they are tested for drugs, the drugs will be there because they're expected to use them. Some of the conclusions I've seen are they don't exist in pharmacologic science. What the DRE is created by police officers, used by police officers, supported and trained by further police officers. There's really no introduction or reliance on legitimate and proven science.
Well, Doc,
I'm going to disagree with that. And
go ahead, Sergeant. Yeah.
There's numerous studies conducted by groups that weren't police officers, like Johns Hopkins University, different studies that support the program. And I'm sure as somebody who works in your field, you're going to look at it from one angle. You're through the lens that you know, and we're looking at it as this person impaired and what's likely causing the impairment. There are a lot of studies for you to just broadly say that there's no basis in fact outside of the law enforcement world of this stuff. I definitely don't agree with that.
Well, and Sergeant, only if I could interject too, is I certainly understand that the position there. I think where the disconnect that I have, and I think maybe where Dr. O'Donnell might be disconnecting, is that, I can recall a specific trial that I had a few years back where an individual was found with a controlled substance in her system, but it was a medication that she'd been taking every day. People develop tolerances, when you're under direct supervision, those are things that, a 45-minute interview just won't be able to tell you. And I think that's the concern is, especially these things on the matrix, pupil size, reaction to light, pulse, blood pressure, all of these are indicators of that, a drug may be in someone's system, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're impaired by that drug.
Well, and as I stated at the beginning, and I absolutely agree with that, just because they're in the system doesn't mean they're impaired. And that's why I said impairment is impairment. You have to have the impairment to get to the point where we're doing a drug recognition evaluation on someone. We get calls from the side of the road, hey, I got a person that says they've taken Suboxone or OxyContin. And we'll ask them, the first question we ask is, how did they do on their field sobriety tests? And if the answer is they did great, then like, okay, they're not impaired right now. Send them on their way. So without impairment, we don't have an evaluation. If you look at the prescription bottle, it's going to say on the, a lot of these medications don't operate heavy machinery.
Just to temper you there, they actually say, be careful when operating heavy machinery until you know how this will affect you. Don't drive. It doesn't. They never say don't drive.
Okay. But what I'm getting at is an impairment. If that person got to us because they were a police officer on the side of the road, did field sobriety tests on a person and determined there was impairment, and then throughout the course of the evaluation, we determined there's impairment, then the role of the drug recognition expert is to say that is likely the category of drugs or drug or drugs that is causing that impairment. I certainly agree that if you're driving down the road and somebody comes across the center line and hits you head on, whether they're using heroin that they got down on the corner someplace or whether they're using something they got from their doctor and you get hit on it, head on and killed, it doesn't matter. Whether it was a prescription drug or an illicit drug, you're still just as dead.
All right, so let me ask, is Dr. O'Donnell, are you still there?
I am.
Okay, do you want to respond to that? Go ahead.
Well, it's sergeant simplifies things. And earlier in the conversation said field sobriety tests provide clues. Caraway said they're validated for alcohol. Many of the indicators that the DRA evaluates is, or comments on, even comment on things that are not part of the indicators, that the carotid vessel was visible. Well, carotid vessels are visible on people that on their neck. A test of the muscle tone, there's no such test that's done in clinical medicine to determine whether what effect a drug has. If muscle tone is either flaccid and you can't move the extremity, or it varies whether or not someone has a degree, it's detectable whether or not someone has a sad fat or not. Droopy eyelids is something I see frequently that's an indicator for CNS depressants. I have droopy eyelids and I don't use any medications. Eyelid flutter, there are no drugs that are known to cause eyelid flutter. I've seen reports.
Dr. Richmond and Dr. Sitek would definitely disagree with you, sir.
Yes, sir. Let me finish, and then I'll let you respond.
Go ahead, doctor.
A few more. The burns. You know, the officer has seen burns on the tongue indicating recent illicit drug use. Yet he admitted using cocaine by nose. You know, making physiologic statements that are scientifically impossible. A person is relaxed after an accident, or their emotion is not consistent with what it should be. DREs are acting like doctors on the street, and they're stretching and they're making conclusions that are not supported. And when they do that, I'm very, very quick to point out where they're violating their own rules and how their own kindergarten pharmacology training is not supported by mainstream medicine.
But doctor, do you agree with Sargent's point saying that, you know, if you look at their success rate at getting it right, I asked him, you know, if you did 100 of these, how many think you get right, how many you get wrong? He said, you know, studies have shown about 92-93%. Is that something you agree with? Because at the heart of this, we only have a few minutes left here, at the heart of all of this is a question of what is the right balance here of how police do their job to make sure that we are safe as motorists as much as possible from people who are impaired drivers versus how much is too far in terms of a court of a law to weigh as evidence when people's lives and their livelihoods are on the line here. And so do you think, doctor, that that the sergeant is correct, that, hey, they're about 92-93%, they get it right most of the time, and that this is a hard job, but it's an important one to undertake, and that for the most part, they may not be as trained as yourself, or they're not taking blood samples at the scene, but they're around in the low 90s, and that's where they are. Do you agree with that?
In the interest of time, I will say that those claims of 90% accuracy are bad. They're faulty science. Number two, the Johns Hopkins study has been debunked. Number three, if indeed the officer suspects a drug impairment, then before arresting an individual, they should take their blood. As we do in Illinois, they take their blood, and if it comes back and proves that someone has an illicit substance or a prescription substance that's in a toxic level, then they're arrested and charged. So that's going to be indisputable. And thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Dr. O'Donnell. I got to give Sergeant Only some time here, and then I know you want to jump in before we go. Go ahead, Sergeant.
I guess the court is the place for the argument in the individual cases. This program is held up to the Frye standard and the Daubert standard in a lot of states nationwide. There's case law that supports the program nationwide. I guess to contradict something that the doctor said, their DREs aren't playing doctor. We're not claiming to be doctors. We don't do a diagnosis on anyone. We're looking at what we see based on the training we have and determining in all likelihood is this substance causing impairment. And to speak to one other thing, we can't take a we're not going to take a blood test prior to arresting somebody on the side of the road. It just is, as we talked about it before, it's just, that's just not possible. And one other thing, aside from the blood results taking months to get back from the laboratory, DREs call no impairment quite a bit. I mean, as part of being a regional coordinator and instructor, we have to review every evaluation that's done across the state. Okay. And DREs call no impairment quite a bit when they get somebody that comes in. It's a very difficult thing to tell a police officer that, hey, I don't have anything to support your case here. You got to let this person go. And it's, again, the integrity of the program. We're trying our level best to do what's right for public safety. And we're not trying to play doctor.
All right, you got to squeeze in about 25 seconds. Go ahead, Dell. You're going to hear the music. Go ahead.
All right. I was just going to say, I certainly agree that police are doing their best, but I think my concern is that this is confirmatory. Like you said, if the officer that arrests them doesn't think they're impaired, the DRE doesn't show up. So I don't believe that's really scientifically objective. There's a couple of things on the DRE that just don't make a lot of sense, like a green film on the tongue for marijuana impairment, which, without admitting too much, I've never seen. So I just think that people should look at this with a critical eye, and that's all I'm really asking.
Well, I feel, turns out we're going to need more time in the future to keep going over this, and our guests have been generous with their time. Del Caraway is an Ontario County Assistant Public Defender. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sergeant David Olney, generous with his time. Station Commander for Troop D, a drug recognition expert and instructor for the New York State Police. Sergeant, thank you very much.
Thanks, Evan, and thanks, Del.
All right, more connections coming up in a moment.